Yeah, no, I certainly don't know of one. There may be one out there somewhere in the literature. There's kind of related stuff like finding the biggest item in a list, or finding even I think there's maybe something finding the kth biggest item. One of the first applications, Grover had an algorithm on finding the median, I think, of a list. And then there's searching in an ordered list. What we do today is searching an unordered database, where so in an ordered list you can't do. It's still O of log n, but you can improve the constant factor in front of that. The thing about, yeah, so sorting. Maybe people haven't done sorting. I mean, you should be able to do. It's possible you could do better on sorting, but you can never do better than O of n, right? Because there's n items in the list, and you have to output n items. So yeah, I doubt you can do a well. Yeah, you might, but maybe you'll do like n square root of log n or something weird like that. I mean, yeah, so it's possible you could improve over classical sorting algorithms. No, not even. I mean, it's not an immediate application anyway. But there may be some paper or two out there. I don't know. I just haven't seen it. I don't remember. Okay. Well, there's still a bunch of people out, but in order to avoid getting too late, maybe we should get started. So there are other questions on. I guess that's a question on what we'll be doing today. But is there a question on stuff we've been doing yesterday or earlier? Shor's algorithm, for instance. No? Okay. How was the tutorial? Did you get through it all? I know that one problem is a bit long, a lot of parts.
We did get through it all.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, so that tutorial is another. Well, it's an application of Fourier transform, but it's another, I think, very important application of quantum computing, because it's actually one of the types of algorithms that probably be the first to be run, because to factor large numbers, well, we can factor pretty big numbers using classical computers, but we're not very good at simulating the dynamics of quantum systems on classical computers, and so a relatively worse a quantum computer could be, right? So a relatively small quantum computer can still do better for simulating Hamiltonian systems than a classical computer. Whereas for factoring, you need a very big quantum computer to beat the best classical computers. Then moving on to today, we have another algorithm that, well, in terms of number of qubits, you don't need lots of qubits to run Grover's algorithm, but you need to be able to run lots of operations for it to really be useful. And so just to remind you, Grover's algorithm is to solve the unstructured search problem. Which is to find a marked element x0 such that O of x0 equals 1. Or if there's no such element, tell you that there's no such element. Okay, so how does Grover's algorithm work? So the point is, Grover's algorithm is going to use O of square root of n queries when there's n inputs, so O maps Zn to Z2. And the kind of the intuition behind this is, well, if you think classically, suppose how would you solve this problem? One way to do it is just try random inputs. Okay, you try random input, but then if there's only one marked element, that's kind of the hardest case, then the probability that any random input will be the right one is 1 over n. And then if you try a second marked element, well, then the probability of finding that one of those two queries that you'll have done will use the right input, that's about 2 over n, right? And if you try k queries, then the probability of finding the right marked elements is about k over n. And if you make sure you don't ask the same thing twice, it's exactly k over n. So in the quantum case, so basically what's happening in the classical case is that we have a probability 1 over n extra with each query, and we can add up the probabilities over multiple trials. Now in the quantum case, we can do superpositions, queries on superpositions of elements. So if we do a superposition over all possible inputs, then the amplitude of each element is 1 over square root of n. And so Grover's algorithm is kind of a way of getting the amplitudes to add up, 1 over square root of n with each query. And so we only need about square root of n queries before the amplitude gets to be order 1, and then we have a high probability of finding the right thing. OK, so that's just kind of a general intuition for how it works. It's hard to go from that to an actual detailed algorithm. So let's be more systematic. So let's start with the case where there's only one marked element. So in this case, there's a complete symmetry between all of the unmarked elements. The marked element is special, but the other ones are all the same. And so we can have an algorithm that treats them symmetrically. Okay, and so that means that we can And so what that means is that we can kind of do most of our work within a particular two-dimensional Hilbert space of the large Hilbert space that consists of an element S, which is just going to be the marked one, a vector S, and a vector T, which is an equal superposition over all of the unmarked elements. Okay, and we'll leave this Hilbert space from time to time to get other states, but we'll always kind of come back to it repeatedly. And we can kind of understand what happens in the algorithm as a whole just by looking at what happens on this two-dimensional Hilbert space that's spanned by superpositions of these two. Okay, and so what we're going to want to do is within this Hilbert space, we're going to want to move towards the state S, because that's the one that tells us what X0 is. Of course, we don't know exactly what the Hilbert space is. We don't know the big Hilbert space. We don't know this subspace because we don't know what x0 is. But our algorithm will nevertheless be designed to preserve this two-dimensional Hilbert space at the appropriate points and move us within that towards S. So let's draw this Hilbert space. Since it's two-dimensional, I can actually do that. This a little higher. Okay. Suppose that we have some state psi that lives in the Hilbert space. Okay. What operations do we know how to do on psi that will stay within this two-dimensional Hilbert space? Polymatrices. How do we? So what? But okay. What polymatrices can we do? How do we do a polymatrix within this two-dimensional Hilbert space? This particular two-dimensional Hilbert space. Okay. So this two-dimensional overspace, remember, is not a tensor product, right? This is a basis state, but this is not. Okay. But one thing we can do is, well, thinking about what we know is we know the oracle. And so what we can, if you think of the Deutsch-Jose algorithm, what we did in the Deutsch-Jose algorithm was basically we said, well, okay, we'll use, we can use the oracle to map any state x to x O of x, and then we can do a phase shift that depends on O of x. And then we undo the O of x, this thing here. So we can do this operation. And of course, using that phase kickback trick, you can get down to just one oracle call. Okay. So using one query, we can do a phase shift that gives us a minus one if the oracle has value one, and a plus one if the oracle has value zero. And that's the difference between S and T. So for T, that's the superposition of all the states that have value zero, and S is the state that has value one. So what we're doing is we're doing a minus sign if S is one. So that is actually one of the polymatrices. It's the sigma Z in this Hilbert space. And the geometrically, what that is a reflection over the t-axis. Okay, so what we can do is we can map psi to this state here. So I'll call this operation minus 1 to the O. And it's reflection over t. Okay, and so that's this state, then would be minus 1 to the O psi. Okay? Everyone see that? Okay, so that's one thing we can do. But of course, if that's all we could do, that wouldn't be enough, because all we could do then is take some state psi and reflect it, and then reflect it back. We would never get anywhere new. We wouldn't get any closer to S in particular. So we're going to need something else. So what else can we do? Well, let's think about it. So maybe what about what states can we create? We don't actually know S. We can't create S. And similarly, we can't create T because we don't know what x0 to leave out of it. But we can easily create the superposition over all states. And what's that? Well, I'll call that U. And U is S plus T. Okay, so that's good. And in particular, we also have a unitary that will take the all zeros state and map it into U. The Hadamard transform will do that. And of course, vice versa, because Hadamard is self-inverse. Okay, so this is not an operation that's within the Hilbert space, because the all zero state, unless that happens to be the marked element, is not within that Hilbert space. But it does give us something, because it gives us a state here. The other thing it does is, if we have a state within the Hilbert space, we can use the Hadamard to map it to some other state. And in particular, if we started with U, we'll get mapped to this all zero state. And then we can do a unitary that's conditioned on this all zero state. So for instance, we can do this diagonal phase gate. Which I'll call F0. And what F0 does is it gives a phase of minus 1 if you have the state all zeros, and plus one otherwise. Or actually, let me do it the other way around. So it'll be plus one if you have all zeros and minus one otherwise. So it's the matrix diagonal plus one, minus one, minus one, and all minus ones. Okay, so 0 goes to 0, and anything else, well, maybe let's call it y, goes to minus y. Okay, so this is, again, something not within the Hilbert space, but combining the Hadamard with F0 gives us something that is within the Hilbert space. So what does it do? In particular, let's define this operation, minus 1 to the u, to be Hadamard F0 Hadamard. And so what that does is it takes a state that's in that Hilbert space. If it's u, it maps it to all zeros. And then the phase is plus 1. And then we get back to where we started. And if we're any state that's orthogonal to u, we get a phase of minus 1. Because it'll get mapped to something that's orthogonal to all zeros. Okay? So what this is a reflection over u. Okay? And I should point out that this doesn't need any queries. Okay, are there questions on that? Okay, so let me draw this again. So here we have S. Here we have T. So there's a state u that's here. And suppose the angle between u and t is theta. And then we have the state psi. And see, the angle between psi and t is phi. Okay. So what happens if we reflect psi? Well, first, if we reflect psi over t, and then we're going to reflect it over u. So we're going to do these two operations in succession. So reflecting over t brings us down here. We have minus 1 to the O psi. And of course, this angle here will also be phi. Then if we reflect over u, well, the angle with u is theta plus phi. So it will be theta plus phi on the other side of u. So it could be theta on the other side of u, of psi. So this here is phi plus theta. And therefore, this angle here is also theta. And so this is minus 1 to the u minus 1 to the o psi. Yeah. Yeah, you're probably right. Yes, this should be, so this angle is phi plus theta. This angle here is 2 theta. So the reflecting over u, so the angle to u is phi plus theta. This here, though, is phi minus theta. So this whole distance is, in fact, phi plus theta, but this then is 2 theta. That's what it was supposed to be. I got that wrong while I was writing it up, but that is indeed the right thing. Okay. And so in particular, the final angle here is now phi plus 2 theta. Because it's gone phi and then 2 theta. So if we define the operation g to be this, then the effect of g is to rotate by an angle 2 theta, which, you know, notice this angle here doesn't depend on phi. It doesn't depend on the initial state we started with. It only depends on theta, the angle between u and t. So it's kind of a property of the oracle rather than a property of whatever state we have. And it rotates this 2 theta, I guess, counterclockwise. So if we start out somewhere over here, we're rotating towards s. What does it need? So if we want to do, say, a pi over 2 rotation, so if we started at t, then to get to s, how many rotations would that need? So well, in general, we need O of 1 over theta rotations. Right? So let's try to figure out what theta is. Well, the way we can figure that out is it's the angle between u and t. So we can just take the dot product of u and t and go from there. So what do we know? Well, so let's normalize. So normalized vectors, we have 1 over root n u, because u is a superposition over all n states. And t is a superposition over n minus 1 states. So we have 1 over root n minus 1 t. And then the dot product between these two things is going to be equal to cosine theta. So that's 1 over root n times n minus 1 times the inner product of u and t. Now, what's the inner product of u and t? Well, t is a superposition over everything but x0. U is a superposition over everything. The x0 term in u just gives us 0, because that's orthogonal to the things in t. And so everything else, each of the other terms gives us 1. So this is n minus 1. So this is going to be n minus 1 over root n minus 1. In other words, square root of n minus 1 over n. And that means that sine theta is square root of 1 minus that squared is 1 over square root of n. OK? And so for n large, well, then theta is about sine theta, which is going to be 1 over root n. And therefore, we need order square root of n queries. OK? So that's, roughly speaking, why we need square root of n queries. OK? Does this make sense? Any questions on it? Yeah. Yeah, that's a problem. So I'm going to define the algorithm more precisely in a moment, and it turns out you can do a more exact analysis of it as well. Yeah. How do we choose the state psi? Yeah, so that's something I'm going to have to define when I tell you what the algorithm is. So why don't I do that then? That seems like it'll answer the questions. Okay. So What is the algorithm precisely? So Grover's algorithm Well, we have to start with some state in this two-dimensional Hilbert space. And the only state we really know how to make is U, right? Because that doesn't depend on knowing about the marked element. So we start out by creating the state U. And we can, of course, do that by doing the Hadamard on the L0 state. OK, so that's step one. And that is what initializes our position here, because we start out here. Okay, and then we're just going to do g again and again, moving 2 theta each time in the direction of s. So we're going to perform some number of iterations, which I'll determine in a moment. And in each iteration, you apply g. Okay? And then at the end of those iterations, you stop and measure the state. And we'll get some x tilde. And what's going to happen is we might necessarily get exactly to s, although you can tweak the algorithm in this case to make sure you do. But let's say we don't get exactly to s. So what we should do, but we'll get close to s. So with high probability, we'll have the right state. And what you should then do is perform another query to test if x tilde equals x. Right? You just plug it into the oracle classically. Sorry, if equals x0. Plug it into the oracle classically, and if you get the output 1, then you're set. If not, then something went wrong, and you have to start again. But you'll succeed with high probability, and therefore you won't have to do this very often before you're very, very likely to get x0. Okay. And so what exactly does this do? Well, so we start with the state at step one here, the state psi 0, which is just u. And so the initial angle from t to psi 0 is theta. And then each time we apply g, we go from psi k minus 1 to psi k, which is equal to, well, it's g psi k minus 1. And in particular, the angle phi k is going to be equal to phi k minus 1 plus 2 theta. So after k steps, this means that we've rotated. We've started with an angle theta from t, and we've rotated to an angle 2k plus 1 times theta. Right? And so what that means is that the state psi k is equal to cosine 2k plus 1 theta times t plus sine 2k plus 1 theta times s. Okay? And in particular, when 2k plus 1 theta is about 2 pi, or sorry, pi over 2, we should stop. So the number of iterations we could perform number of iterations we should perform is when n is large, it's pi over 2. We need 2k plus 1, theta is equal to pi. When n is large, the 1 is kind of negligible. So what we should do is we should perform pi over 4 times 1 over theta, which is pi over 4 times 1 over square root of n. Sorry, times square root of n iterations. OK? So does this answer the questions? Yeah. It didn't answer your question yet. We'll get to it in a minute. But the point is that we stop after a specific number of iterations. And so we're close to the maximum value. Okay? But are there other questions on Grover's algorithm? How do we start with another query? Oh, well, you just start all. So, what do you mean? So, this is just a classical query in this last step to check. And if it doesn't work, then you clear all the qubits and start from step one again. Yeah, it's you again. OK? So but as Ali points out, if you wait too long to stop, then the thing will start to rotate away from s and back towards, well, minus t. OK? So it's actually important that this is not a case where you can say, oh, well, you know, I really want a really, really good success probability, so I'll just do more iterations of g. No, it doesn't work that way. If you do too much, the probability gets worse. And then, you know, if you do enough, it'll get better again. But that's just being kind of silly, right? So it's important that you stop at the right time when you do this. So that's actually going to be an issue then when we move beyond the case of a unique marked element. So let's next do that. So now let's assume there are t-marked elements. So what happens then? Well, we can apply almost the same analysis. In this case, we can treat not just the unmarked element, we can treat the unmarked element symmetrically, but we can also treat the marked element symmetrically. Because what we ask from this algorithm is not that it find every marked element, but that's just that it find any marked element, finds a valid marked element. And if you imagine like an NP-complete problem, like satisfiability, that's sufficient, right? Because you just want to know if there exists a satisfying assignment, not what the full list of possible satisfying assignments is. So if there's T-marked elements, so then we're going to let S be the sum over marked x, and t will be the sum over unmarked x. And once we do that, the rest of the analysis is going to be very similar. Yeah. Let's assume for the moment that we do. Okay, and after that, I'll relax that assumption too. But let's say that t is known. OK, and so after this, basically the same analysis goes through. We say, well, OK, we can still do this minus 1 to the O operation. Why? Well, when we apply the oracle, the phase kickback oracle, that gives a minus sign to all of the marked elements. and a plus sign to the unmarked elements. Okay? So that's still a reflection over T. Well, this reflection over U, that of course is the same because U is still S plus T. U is the superposition over all X. And so that's still S plus T. So that part is the same. And well, this whole argument follows through. The only thing that's different is that theta is different. So what's theta in this case? Well, we can calculate cos theta the same way. And so that's going to be the inner product between the normalized u and the normalized t. So the normalized u still has a 1 over square root of n. The normalized t is now a superposition over n minus t things. So we have this. And of course, this inner product now will be n minus t, because that's the number of things in t. And so this is square root of n minus t over n. And so sine theta is square root of t over n. OK? And so then if you follow through Grover's algorithm, you'll see that you get that the angle phi becomes about pi over 2, instead of doing it at for pi over 4 times square root of n iterations, we should do stop after pi over 4 times square root of n over t iterations. Okay, and this kind of makes sense, right? Because, well, when there's more marked elements, it should be easier to find the marked element. And that's what we're seeing, that that we can do it with fewer queries. Okay, one thing that's worth noting is that classically, when there's T marked elements and you're trying them randomly, then you're going down from n time to n over T time. In this case, we're going down from square root of n time to square root of n over t. So even though there's t marked elements, we're not improving by a factor of t. We're only improving by a factor square root of t. Okay, because Grover's algorithm is taking the square root of that too, effectively. Okay, nevertheless, it's still an improvement. Basically, we're doing the square root of the classical number of queries that we have to do. Okay. And one thing that's worth thinking about for a second is which x0 will we get out of this algorithm? Well, we're rotating to S, and then we're measuring in the basis, standard basis. So what we're getting, and S is superposition equals superposition over all the marked elements. So what we're getting is a random marked element. So there are questions on this. Okay, good. So now what happens when t is unknown? Yeah. Well, so what you've done is you've rotated towards S, and then when you measure, you'll get a random marked element with high probability. I mean, it won't be exactly S, so it's a small possibility of getting something from T. Okay? So what happens if t then is unknown? Okay, so it seems like this is going to cause trouble, right? Because in order to know where to stop, we have to know what t is, right? If there's only one marked element, we should stop after pi over 4 square root of n iterations. If there's two, it should be pi over 4 times square root of n over 2 iterations. And if we go too long, then the probability of success will decrease again, okay? And so if we really have no idea what t is, we really have no idea how long to run it. Okay, so this seems like a problem. So let's think some more about what happens to the state when we run it for some amount of time with an unknown number of marked elements. Well, so what we can do is we can plot the success probability, so meaning the probability of getting a marked element when we measure, versus time, meaning number of iterations. Well, it starts out to be very, very close to zero, right? Because there's only the classical probability, t over n, of finding the marked element. And then it goes up and up and up. And so this is plus 1, and down here is going to be minus 1. Up and up and up, and it gets all the way up to 1, or very close. But then it starts to go down again. And then if we wait long enough, the amplitude becomes minus 1. And if, sorry, this should be success amplitude. Not going to have probability minus 1 of success. So the amplitude goes down to minus 1, which means, of course, the probability of success is back up to plus 1. But then if we keep on going, the amplitude will go up again, so the success probably goes down, and so on. Okay? And what will happen is we'll get, well, not very well drawn, but mathematically, it will be a cosine. Or I guess this is a sine. Sorry, sine. Well, so it's roughly sine of t. So what it is exactly, it's sine of 2k plus 1 times theta. I couldn't call it t because t is number of answers. And in particular, the period of this thing is going to be pi times square root of n over t. I guess in the limit where n is large. Okay? So what is that telling us? Well, it's telling us that if we want to find t, what we need to do is we need to measure the period of this oscillation. Well, how do we measure the period of a function? Shor's algorithm does that. Okay? So in order to find t and to do Grover's algorithm, well, there's other ways to do Grover's algorithm in this case. But in order to find t, one really good way is to just apply Shor's algorithm, what we were doing earlier this week. So how do we do that in this case? Well, so first, what you do is you create an ancilla. Yeah. Well, it so it will be yeah. So it will be, yeah. I mean, yeah. I mean, in some sense, that's all Schur's algorithm is. It's a discrete Fourier transform. But Schur's algorithm is maybe a little bit more. You have to create the appropriate superposition and then do the quantum Fourier transform on that. Okay, and so that's what we're going to do. So what we want to do is we want to create an ancilla that's in a superposition over the number of possible queries. And then do a controlled operation to apply g k times. And then we do the Fourier transform and measure. So what does that look like? So we're going to have two registers. Each of them will be multiple qubits. This one is the ancilla, kind of, although it's kind of where the data is going to be stored. So this is the thing that we're running Grover's algorithm on, kind of. And so the first thing for Grover's algorithm is to put it in the state U. And so we do the Hadamard. This is doing the ancilla, putting the ancilla in superposition. And so then here we have this controlled g to the k operation, where k is determined by this first ancilla register. And so at this point, the state is sum over k, k times what we get by doing Grover's algorithm k times. And then we do the Fourier transform on this first register and measure it to get an estimate of the period. Okay, so again, there's some details like what range of k do you have to run this over? It's not really enough to do just one period. The Fourier transform then won't be sufficiently peaked at inverse of the period. So you have to do many, many periods. But that's okay because you can, even with just a modest number of qubits, you can represent very large numbers, right? Exponentially large numbers. The problem, of course, is that then you have to apply g to that many times. So it's you don't want it to be order n things, but that's okay actually. It just has to be some multiple of square root of n. And the thing is that you won't get the period exactly. So instead, what we're going to do is we're going to approximately measure the period. And that will give us some approximate counting of t. And the longer you run this superposition, the bigger value of k you include in this ancilla, the more accurate an approximation you'll get. But if you want to get an exact value or very close to exact, then you'll have to run it for order n time, and you won't be any better than classical. But so long as you're willing to tolerate some error on t, then you can still improve on the classical case. So this is actually, while it's useful for Grover's algorithm, because once you know this approximate value, well, then you can run Grover's algorithm one more time for roughly the right amount of time and find, well, one or a few more times. And find x0 then. But it also does something more than Grover's algorithm, right? Because in this case, we're not just saying whether there exists a Mark element, we're saying how many there are. Okay, and so that's something that's kind of beyond what you ask from an NP complete problem, for instance. So it's even harder. Okay. Yeah. What happens if it doesn't exist at all? Well, okay. So actually, even in the case, so let's just imagine a simpler case where there's either zero marked elements or one marked element. So in that case, you say you run it for the pi over 4 square root of n iterations. You get some answer. You check to see if it's marked or not. If it's not marked, you say, oh, something went wrong maybe, so I'll try it again. Now, if there's one marked element, then the probability of success each time is 1 minus epsilon. Okay, so if you try this, you know, 20 times and you haven't succeeded, that rather strongly suggests that maybe there wasn't a marked element at all. Now doing that in this case is a little harder because the probability of success is no longer 1 minus epsilon. You only have an approximation of t, so you don't know exactly the right amount of time to run it. But your approximation is good enough that, you know, maybe you have a half probability of finding a marked element each time. And in that case, if you've done it 20 times and you haven't found the marked element, well, that's only a probability of 1 over 2 to the 20 of that happening. So again, it's pretty unlikely in that case that there are any marked elements. Actually, it's even more than that, because you've done an approximate counting, right? So your approximate counting is telling you that there's not very many marked elements. It's not telling you whether there's 0 or 1 or 2, because it's only approximate. But you already know it's kind of low. So that's helping too. OK? Any other questions? OK. So on the homework problems, you'll get to look at some applications of Grover's algorithm. So some other algorithms which are kind of based on Grover's algorithm, or things that you can do using Grover's algorithm. But there's really lots and lots of possible applications. Basically, anything, any kind of algorithm where you say, well, I need to try n things, and sooner or later, one of them will work. Well, then you can use Grover's algorithm to say, well, I'll do a quantum search over those n things to find the one that works. The important part of this is that when you find the one that works, well, there's two things. So first, it's important that when you find the one that works, you can recognize that. Because in order to do this minus 1 to the O reflection, you have to be able to identify the marked elements when given to them, when they're presented to you. And the other thing is that if your search involves learning from experience, so you say, well, I tried this and it doesn't work, so that suggests I tried this as a result of that. Or I tried this and I got some information, and based on that, I can do a better thing the next time. So in that case, Grover's algorithm doesn't immediately help you. Okay. So this is only for searches where each trial is just blind, and you don't learn from experience, except that the old ones didn't work. Okay, so but then there's various refinements people have thought of using like layered Grover's algorithm or other kinds of things that in some cases allow you to improve even those kinds of classical searches. Okay. Okay, so since I have a little bit of time left, let me say a couple of words. I'm not going to go through anything like a whole proof, but a couple of words about how we know that this is an optimal algorithm. So I mentioned this yesterday, that that any quantum algorithm for this unstructured search problem has to take at least square root of n time. Okay, so how do you prove something like this? Well, there's actually a bunch of different techniques that people have used. One that I think is kind of cool is called the adversary method. So the adversary method, the way it works is, in this case, it's the quantum adversary method. So you imagine that the oracle is not completely defined, that actually the oracle is a superposition over all possible oracles. Let's take the all let's specialize to the t equals one case. So it'll be all possible oracles that have one marked element. Okay, and Grover's algorithm then is supposed to find which one it is. So what does that mean? Well, so that means we start with some sort of tensor product state. Let's say we have all zeros in our computer, and we have a register that says which oracle we have. Okay, so and this thing here, this Oracle register is actually a sum over all oracles that have one marked element. Okay? And we want to find what that oracle is. So that means at the end, our computer should also know what O is. But we're not ever destroying this superposition. We still have a superposition over all possible oracles. And so what we're supposed to do is we're supposed to end with the superposition over all oracles of O in our computer, and the oracle still knows that it's oracle O. Okay? So this thing here is a tensor product state. And this thing here is a maximally entangled state. Okay? So the way this proof works is it says, well, I'm not going to do the proof, but the proof says we can only add a certain amount of entanglement per oracle call. So each query can only slightly increase the entanglement. And we start with a tensor product state. We end with a maximally entangled state. And so what that means is we need a lot of queries to go all the way between those. Okay? And once you do all the arithmetic, it turns out the number of queries you need is omega square root of n. And yeah, so there's obviously various calculations and other things you have to do to back that up and complete the proof. But this kind of gives you a sense, maybe, of how you could actually prove something like this. Okay. But the other thing you notice about this doesn't tell you anything really about the other operations that go into this. So it's only saying that each query can only change the entanglement by so much. It doesn't tell you anything about, how many gates you're doing on this first register. You could be doing lots and lots of gates or very few gates. As it happens, Grover's algorithm doesn't require very many gates for each iteration. Each iteration is only, basically n gates plus the oracle call, or O of n gates plus the oracle call. But query complexity only counts queries. So something that had, many, many more gates and many, many more qubits, but still only had a small number of queries would have low query complexity. And this is just a bound on the query complexity. Okay. So that's probably enough for today. So next week, we'll instead of discussing algorithms, we'll discuss kind of other kind of quantum information protocols. We'll be discussing maybe probably quantum data compression, certainly quantum error correction, and quantum cryptography.